listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggle for love and revolution. Love and revolution. This week on Love and Revolution Radio, Greg Mello from the Los Alamos Study Group speaks about the historic UN treaty that could ban the manufacturing, possession, and use of nuclear weapons. He also shares sobering insights into the Dr. Strangelove mentalities of Los Alamos National Laboratory scientists, Kirtland Air Force Base nuclear soldiers, and the nuclear war hawks who are circling Capitol Hill.
We're in a brand new political paradigm now. There are new opportunities and new dangers, and history is happening very fast, and we can be part of that. And it's very positive as well as very scary. You know, the movie Dr. Strangelove, for those who haven't seen it, remains extremely accurate. The attitudes which are there, they persist in the heart of the nuclear weapons establishment.
Before you, with her hands on her hips, she said, "I'll accept love and loving words from your lips." She said, "Everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution."
Hello and welcome to all of our listeners on Love and Revolution Radio. This is your host, Rivera Sun, flying solo for the second week. Don't worry, we'll have Sherry back on next week. We've been juggling schedules with her trip to New Zealand and back. She's right now, as we're recording, teaching a workshop that I wish I could be at, where she's doing spiritual activism and nonviolent action and strategy for movement building. Incredible work that she does. She's an amazing teacher and trainer, and I know our listeners out there, you appreciate all these little nonviolent struggle and strategy tips we've been spinning out over the airwaves week after week, so we'll bring them back, don't worry. So this week, you have myself and our guest, Greg Mello. Greg works with the Los Alamos Study Group. Now, contrary to what some of you might be thinking, this is not a Los Alamos National Laboratory study group on how to make bigger, bolder, and more effective and dangerous nuclear weapons. No, no, no. This is a group that has been around since 1989 and has been providing leadership on nuclear disarmament and related issues in New Mexico at the national level and also international. They have quite a reputation. They're well known for a reasoned and researched approach to the issues around nuclear weapons, and also for understanding very clearly, like so many of us do in the world, that nuclear weapons are not spelling anything but danger and disaster for the human species. Their job and their role is to make the arguments with the facts, with the figures, with the names, with the places, and to make sure that people are well educated and informed about both the problems and the real practical solutions and routes to disarmament and abolition. So Greg is going to talk with us today about a number of nuke-related issues, but where I'd love to start off with is something that's brewing as we record and something that could have major effects on the world scene of nuclear weapons. In front of the UN right now is a treaty that has come about because they're under a mandate to negotiate a treaty that might have effects on abolishing nuclear weapons. So welcome to the show, Greg. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to have this conversation, and thank you for all the work that you consistently do day after day on this issue. Tell us what's going on at the UN.
Thank you, Rivera, for having me on. And it's a joyful occasion right now because of this milestone at the United Nations. So basically what's happened is that non-nuclear weapon states, states which aren't dependent on nuclear weapons, don't have nuclear weapons, haven't been promised protection under any kind of nuclear umbrella by NATO or the United States, have grown impatient and even disgusted with the lack of disarmament progress, with the paralysis that has occurred during the Obama administration. And they are beginning to take their own steps. Now, they've always been obligated under the NPT to do that. That the NPT says all nation states have to work on disarmament. And some of us considered that for a long time, well, that's the ones that have nuclear weapons that need to work on disarmament. But there's a new approach that's based on an old approach. Basically, nuclear weapons can't possibly be legal to use under any circumstances, so they violate all the laws of war, the humanitarian laws. And there's been an increasing movement led by a pretty broad coalition of countries to ban nuclear weapons the way chemical weapons and biological weapons are banned or prohibited. Historically, banning or prohibiting something has preceded the gradual elimination. So that is the hope. So what's just happened is that the first committee of the General Assembly has voted by a vote of 123 for, 38 against, and 16 abstentions to negotiate a treaty to ban nuclear weapons next year. This has never happened before. It harkens all the way back to the very first resolution of the General Assembly. The leadership is not coming from the nuclear weapon states. In fact, they are apoplectic about it and have been trying to twist arms and break arms to keep people from voting for this, but they haven't succeeded. In fact, some of their efforts have backfired. So what will now happen with virtual certainty is that the General Assembly as a whole will ratify this decision of the first committee, which basically includes everybody. And then there will be negotiations next year, concluding in the first half of the year, about a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. Now, we can be sure the United States has already said we are boycotting these negotiations. We, all right-thinking countries like us, should not take part. This is a terrible thing. And it could cause nuclear war. That's what, you know, what they say. But they're going to go ahead, and there's a lot of substantial expertise behind it from foreign ministries. There's Austria, Mexico, Ireland, Nigeria, South Africa. It's pretty much universal in the global south, the support of this approach. And there is a campaign of involving, gosh, more than 400 NGOs in almost 100 countries that are working to convince their parliaments and foreign ministries to do this. And it's been very successful. It's very diverse. A lot of the NGOs are working on development goals and poverty, climate. It's kind of inherently intersectoral, and it's a fabulous movement, and it's been very successful so far.
Well, that is, as you said, a hopeful note in a field that doesn't actually get a lot of hopeful moments. I mean, you've been working on this issue for a long time. I've spoken with you about it before in person, and I know that the feeling is not always one of hope, so I'm glad to hear that. You know, it makes me reflect that the Obama administration approved $1 trillion over the next 30 years for nuclear weapons, and the massive mobilization and a little bit of miracles and passing of this treaty, maybe we might be looking at a scenario where we could be spending that money on student education instead of nuclear weapons. For me, that sounds like a much more sensible investment strategy for our populace's security and well-being. But that's just me. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, of course, the U.S. is boycotting this process so far. It's hardly surprising they've been doing that with almost every similar process for the past, well, I guess 70 years since they started inventing nuclear bombs. But what can we expect from our, you know, representatives and officials as this process continues? I read in your Los Alamos study group newsletter that One person is quoted as saying the U.S. and other nuclear nations don't just strong arm the rest of the country officials, they break arms and they try to do whatever it takes to sink treaties and deals like this. What kind of challenges are we looking at in the next phase of this work? And do you think the treaty will actually make it through the process?
Those are really great questions. And first, I should say that this is not a treaty that would apply to countries that don't sign it. I mean, it would. What we've got right now is two warring ideas about nuclear weapons. That nuclear weapon states like the United States and Russia claim that they can have nuclear weapons as many and as long as they want. India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea are not under any kind of regime, whereas 187 countries have signed a treaty which forever forbids them to acquire nuclear weapons. And they tend to believe that nuclear weapons are inherently illegitimate. So we have the legitimate of the people who think that nuclear weapons are inherently legitimate and the ones who think that they're inherently illegitimate. And these two worldviews are at war. And this treaty aims to clarify that. And so there would be a gradual accession or joining of countries to the treaty, and it would stigmatize nuclear weapons and stigmatize all the countries which had them or depended on them. And it's already driving a wedge into the European countries. So in the Netherlands, for example, there's a strong anti-nuclear movement, and they were able to get the Netherlands to abstain on this vote instead of voting with the United States, which is a pretty good step forward. Countries that feel like they are respectful of human rights will come under a lot of internal pressure because of this. Now, the next step would be to actually negotiate the treaty. Then the negotiators are supposed to report to the General Assembly 1 year from now, and either then something would happen within the General Assembly, which is most likely, or a group of countries could step away from the process if it got all paralyzed and just do it themselves and then bring it back to the General Assembly, and countries might join. So there are many different pathways starting about the middle of next year or late next year, depending. But I think there's quite a good chance that this will happen. If the listeners might compare it to a global version of a nuclear weapon-free zone treaty, of which we have several already, and it would basically patch the loopholes in existing nuclear weapon-free zone treaties and extend the norm or standard or law by over the whole world, leaving the United States and other nuclear weapon states as outlaws. And so it wouldn't apply directly. It's not a weapon elimination treaty. It's a weapon stigmatization and treaty.
That's very helpful and very kind of heartening clarification to understand that there's multi-prongs of how this might move forward and larger overall strategy that can move forward almost regardless of this particular treaty that we're trying to stigmatize and really assert a worldview and isolate those countries that believe that nuclear weapons are the best way to go. It's really a reclaiming the moral high ground for the planet on this issue.
Very much so.
Yeah, it's a very powerful approach and very needed. Even as a citizen of the United States, I have to cheer on the feeling of our great big bullying country sort of getting itself kind of boxed into a corner, morally speaking. One question that I have is about this $1 trillion 30-year program that we're about to head into in the United States, which is called the Modernization Program. It manipulates a loophole in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, I believe, and allows us to modernize the nuclear arsenal, which is really proliferating nuclear weapons, inventing new types of nuclear weapons, and upgrading everything that we have now. I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on the broader scope of the modernization plan, how it does exploit that loophole, and then also what this treaty means in terms of the modernization. My last part of that question is, I know just a small amount about what the U.S. is planning in terms of modernization, but I can only assume that the other 8 nuclear weapons holding nations are also planning similar modernizations and expansions. Could you comment on that?
Certainly. First, the modernization program is a big part, say about a third, or depending on how you count it, a half of the $1 trillion nuclear weapons expenditure plan for the next 30 years. The other half or two-thirds is simply maintaining, deploying the weapons, both the old ones and then as the new ones come in, then the new ones. So some of that is operational, but you can, as a shorthand, you can just consider it all modernization, I think, without veering too far from the truth. Every single type of warhead and delivery system, the communications, the targeting, the everything about this is to be modernized. And it's really the biggest investment in this since Ronald Reagan. And it's happening because the systems that were put in place under the Reagan administration are aging. And some parts of them are just fine. Other parts are not just fine or will soon not be just fine. And in the process of replacing the aging parts, it's difficult in a technologically modernizing society to not want to replace those parts with more capable ones. And this is true for the delivery systems. So the new delivery systems, the planes will be stealthy. The bombs will have more flexible yields. The fusing systems that determine where the bomb blows up and when it blows up, some of them are very sophisticated and can correct for trajectory errors. And so the submarine launched warheads in particular can become, instead of just an area-wide weapon or a weapon that you have to, say, fire 3 of them at a particular target that's hardened and buried, now you could get away with only 1. And that means you have 2 more warheads to use for something else. So, in other words, it's about 3 times as effective. And that's just from replacing the brain in the warhead with a more modern version. And this is very destabilizing, by the way, because it effectively multiplies the number of warheads that are available and makes the Russians have to think about what we're going to do with those warheads. Submarines can get very close to Russia, and the trajectories may not be visible to Russian early warning until the last minute. So all of this makes us much more dangerous because the hair trigger alert posture, which the Russians would have, the decision time is shortened. And the military tends to think this is really great, but they're just very specialized. They have a warfighting mentality, they're not looking at the big picture, honestly.
Greg, can I just ask a little question about that big picture? I don't want to deviate too much from the modernization, sure. But one thing that goes along with this modernization and the multiplication of our available warheads due to this whole change and a question that really came up when you said the words they want to make more stealthy bomber planes to go and drop the bombs is, I mean, there's a prevailing theory that we actually can never drop the bombs, that this would trigger nuclear war and thus nuclear winter, and that we actually already have enough bombs to destroy the whole world 6 times over. But I just don't understand, I guess, as a layperson, why we need to upgrade and modernize a system that is already redundant in terms of its explosive capacity and unusable in terms of its effect on causing nuclear winter. Could you just explain that to me?
Sure. So first of all, we don't have to modernize all that stuff, of course. And the disciples of strict deterrence might say that we need 1/3 less to cover all possible future scenarios. Others say we need only 10% of what we have. I'm talking about Air Force strategists here, not anti-nuclear activists. So there's some very low numbers in terms of warhead and arsenals that are kicked around by professionals in the business. But politically, they feel they have to feed the beast, all the contractors, all the states that have bases, the politicians that come from the states with the bases and the contractors. And so it ends up being a full-on modernization of everything plan, which at the same time, many senior Obama administration officials will readily say we can't possibly pay for. So they know something will give, but they just are basically politically pushing it past the end of this administration. So no, we don't need it. Second, there is still a war-fighting mentality that exists in the Strategic Command and elsewhere in the targeting staff. They like to say they look at all options, and they do believe that they can terminate a conventional war that is escalating, that the United States is losing, by using nuclear weapons. And they can get away with it without having a full-on nuclear war. They hope they can get away with it. And then on the subject of nuclear winter, someone who was at a recent meeting of an interagency meeting of very senior officials, the senior-most officials that work on these questions, tells us that the question of nuclear winter came up at the formal meeting and in the question period, and the response from the senior most officials was that we don't believe in it, that this was something that was discredited. Well, the truth is completely opposite, that it's not only were the fears confirmed, but they were extended and made much more specific with modern climate models. So what we've got there in the nuclear weapons field in Washington is a very closed echo chamber that makes decisions much as if the Cold War never ended. And in fact, of course, it's starting up again.
Well, maybe that's a really good thing to bring up for our listeners. You know, as we're talking about modernization, we did speak a little bit about Russia and what our modernization strategies mean for what Russia feels they must prepare for. Now, this is happening simultaneous to tensions that our two countries are feeling towards one another that are being greatly aggravated by U.S.-NATO maneuvers, say, on the Russian border. With the tensions with Russia and with this return into a second Cold War, what are we looking at in terms of the nuclear issue and in terms of our relationship to Russia? And we didn't mention the other, I guess, besides the U.S. and Russia, the other seven nuclear nations and how they play into this. So maybe we could talk about multipolarity and the end of the hegemony, as well as the U.S. and Russia relationship.
The subject of the negotiating mandate for a treaty banning nuclear weapons immediately takes you into the realm of the changing power structure in the world. So the United States has been, and the Western nuclear weapon states, with relatively smaller contribution from Russia and China, have been able to control the nuclear debate and in such a way that no one really questioned their leadership before. Now there is a rebellion going on. And I think it's a symptom of the decline of U.S. power relative to the uses that we want to put it to. So we can control the whole world, basically, and the whole world realizes that, and increasingly. So this vote in the UN is symptomatic of that. We should mention also the other nuclear weapon states, which are, you know, if there were a war between India and Pakistan, it would create enough nuclear winter for really most of the human race to starve. Maybe not most, but 1 billion or 2 billion. It's a little hard to tell, even with the best climate models. the arsenals of India and Pakistan are fully capable of generating a nuclear winter that would darken the northern hemisphere and produce freezing temperatures for a long time, eliminate food crops. And so there's a lot of danger there. And just as you said, all the nuclear weapon states are modernizing, and some, like India and Pakistan and North Korea, are increasing their arsenals. In fact, Pakistan is increasing their arsenal faster than anyone. So there is a real need for a global consensus that this is not a good thing. We don't have that, but we're on the way to getting it. Let's see. Tensions with Russia are making this difficult right now, and we see some sort of change in the Obama administration, a kind of a changing of the balance in forces within the administration, perhaps about 3 years ago. And increasingly, hardliners have come to be in charge of policy toward Russia, and sometimes we think they are taking actions all by themselves without approval by the president. As, for example, when the Syrian army was bombed at Deir ez-Zor. And now we don't know who is saying that the U.S. Army will take part in a ground invasion of Syria, which was announced just recently by Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense. We don't really know how widely that idea of the U.S. ground invasion of Syria has been vetted within the U.S. government. A lot of this is about Russia. And Russian hardliners have basically hijacked or taken over U.S. policy, and that means it's very difficult to even keep the treaties we have, let alone make any new ones. So with respect to Russian modernization, yes, they are modernizing, and they see a threat from U.S. missile defenses. They see a threat from NATO moving forces directly onto the Russian border, which is unprecedented. And so they are taking compensatory steps as they see it. And the accidental on purpose leak of a doomsday undersea bomb by Russia that could throw a gigantic radioactive wave over the West Coast was a way of saying it is futile to pursue a missile defense program and try to destabilize the relationship that we have, as they see it, because there are relatively easy workarounds which we could put into play that you wouldn't like. In other words, if you want to have an arms race, we'll show you an arms race. And that's the situation that we're in with this modernization, which has to be seen in the context of a much larger geopolitical struggle to prevent the economic integration of Eurasia and free trade between Europe and Russia that could turn Europe more toward Russia. And this is, of course, you know, the most terrible thing that could happen, some people would say. So we have to, this is destabilize countries on Russia's border, create problems for Russia, try to develop fifth columns in Russia. All this activity is going on, as well as nuclear modernization. And the modernization piece has to be seen in that broader context.
Well, you know, one of the things about the arms race or the Second Cold War and this modernization is really, I keep coming back to the what else could we do with $1 trillion? It's not like the United States is in such robust economic shape that we can sustain or afford this. It's not like the populace is fully employed. It's not like we don't have crippling poverty and staggering debt already. Our listeners will know that we cover these issues on Love and Revolution Radio, that we talk with people on the ground in their communities who are struggling to pay rent, who are struggling to pay bills, who can't afford health care. We have some major issues right here at home in the United States that will never be solved by any sort of geopolitical economic maneuvering of the world powers that require the attentiveness of the concentrated effort of our populace, the care of our hearts to take care of one another. And this is what goes out the window the moment we start to invest into arms races and cold wars. And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and a special guest in our Nonviolence Minute. On this week's Nonviolence Minute, we have a special guest. Usually, Sherry or I will give you a little nonviolent history or a little nonviolent strategy tip. But this week, we're going to bring on Jerry Monroe Maynard, who some of our listeners will remember from our School of the Americas Watch show just a week ago, because Jerry doesn't rest. He works for peace, even in his sleep, apparently, because he is the initiator of a project called No War November, which he's going to tell you about. Jerry, welcome back to Love and Revolution Radio.
Hey, Rivera, thank you very much for having me back on, and thank you for letting me explain my campaign. Last year, actually, was the first time I attempted to do this campaign, and I'm calling this a hybrid campaign. And the reason why is because I want to make sure to bridge the gap between organizers who organize on the ground, person to person, directly, and those who organize on social media. Because I think both are two very key important strategies for people to utilize in our day and age for impactful and effective organizing. So I came up with this campaign called No War, hashtag No War November. And my idea was to have each day of the week for 30 days be dedicated to a different type of creative resistance. So I'll just go through what each day of the week would look like during the month, and I'm encouraging each person to pick one or two of these days and dedicate your time for the month of November to practicing those two forms of resistance. So the week goes as follows. The first day, Meditate Monday, hashtag Meditate Monday. That's a day where you take the time to sit with yourself and learn how to disarm your inner violence through the ancient practice of meditation. You can do that as individual or you can do it in group. Then the second would be hashtag Truthful Tuesday, where you tell the truth of nonviolence, how nonviolence is more effective than violent resistance, and tell the truth about the evils of war. Then you have hashtag Witness Wednesday, where you are encouraged to go out into the public and to do some type of public action for peace and justice, and encourage people to practice nonviolent resistance in the public. Thursday is called Thoughtful Thursday, where you go out of your way to do something thoughtful and kind for other people, because people in organizing and movement building forget that, you know, we have to be kind to one another, because in the end, we're all in this together. So either we survive together or we fail together. And then Friday is called Fast Friday, and that's when you are encouraged to fast from preferably animal products or anything that you really enjoy consuming as a way of being in solidarity with the world's poor who are suffering through the violence of hunger and poverty each day. So this is a way of feeling in your body solidarity with the poor of the world. Saturday is Social Saturday, where you go out and you're encouraged to have a social events to build camaraderie and solidarity with your community and to show people that there are other people out there who have the same beliefs as you. And lastly, the last day of the week is hashtag Service Sunday, where you go out and you be a warm body in your community and you do some type of community work to build up your community and to be a public witness for compassion in the world.
Let me jump in there and just ask a quick question, which is one of the interesting things about this No War November campaign is that you're really kind of taking a two-handed oppose and propose strategy to the whole question of war as usual. It's like the bumper stickers people see, or the slogan of the 60s, make love, not war, that you're really asking people to assert themselves in a peaceful, nonviolent, kindness and compassion and service-oriented way in the world, but with the understanding that every step we take for peace is a step in the opposite direction of war. Could you talk a little bit about that connection?
That's exactly what it is. It's, you know, it's about understanding that when you choose to be a force of good, you also at the same time have to be willing to say that evil is evil and we choose not to cooperate with it. You know, Gandhi says that cooperation with the good is just as much important as non-cooperation with evil. This is the line in the sand for nonviolence, that you choose to live creatively and passionately in the world without using the means of destruction that war and evil promote. So this is the line in the sand, you know, this is the boundary line, so to speak. So yeah, we want to constantly live in that way so that people know that this is what it means to be human. This is how what it means to practice compassion in our world. So you have to have that two-sided coin to create peace, I believe.
Well, this is very timely, Jerry, because the Veterans for Peace also have a November peace campaign, which is around Armistice Day on November 11th. They are really concertedly trying to reclaim Armistice Day and remind people that Armistice Day was a peace commemoration, not a celebration of war and violence and militarism, or even just an honoring of the veterans, that what it really is about as a holiday is a commemoration of the act of peace coming after a long period of war. So they're trying to really do that work, and your No War November really supports and affirms and uplifts the whole spirit of that work. Jerry, where can people follow this campaign or learn more about it?
If you go online and go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/CNVHOU1, the number one, that's our Facebook page where you can see all of our postings about the campaign. And if you also just go onto Facebook and type in hashtag No War November, there is a Facebook group page that is public that you can join. And that's where people are encouraged to post pictures, articles that they write about the campaign, and everything that they're doing in their local communities during the month of November. And like I said, I encourage people to pick one or two of those days that I listed and really focus on those for the month and really aim to make a nonviolent impact in the world.
Great. For our listeners, we will include those links in our show notes on our weekly email that we send out and also on our Podomatic channel. Jerry, thank you for joining us on Love and Revolution Radio to let us know about this campaign and about the work that you're doing for peace.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm always happy to be on, and I hope everybody has a great No War November.
And now, let's return to our program. I like how you're framing this, Greg, and how you're making us understand that nuclear weapons don't stand alone on what's going on around the globe, and they also don't stand alone in terms of what's going on here in our own country. And I think that when we're looking to address it, we have to all be like you, Greg. We have to really devote ourselves to understanding not just the specifics of our own issue, but how they all connect. I was wondering if there's more that you would like to say about the intersectionality of the nuclear weapons, the treaty. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the understanding of how nuclear weapons and the need for disarmament fits into the broader understanding of intersectionality?
So there's at least a couple of ways. So you've touched on the financial aspect. I can report to you that within the nuclear weapons establishment, when people like me go to a conference or a breakfast near Republican Capitol Hill Club, they're talking about nuclear weapons, I ask a question, you know, how is this all going to be paid for? Well, the answer is we're going to take it from domestic programs. They're very clear. They can't say we're going to raise taxes. They can't say we're going to increase the national debt to pay for all this. They say we're going to take it from Medicare. They say we'll take it from Social Security. They say that explicitly to each other. And from within the Pentagon, they say, well, we can take it from, let's say, the Army, or we can take it from some other part of the Pentagon. But then to mollify the tensions within the military world, they'll say, well, we'll just increase the military budget overall, and then we'll all be taken care of. So there is the struggle going on in Washington right now. And nuclear weapons are kind of a capstone question, because we wouldn't need nearly so many if we weren't. They're connected with our self-conception as an empire. Now, shifting over a little bit. So there's the direct fiscal intersectionality of it all. But more than that, there's a different kind of politics that develops. And it's partly intellectual and moral, and it's partly which committees people go on and how much attention is paid in the, you know, in the overall bandwidth of Congress to different aspects of security. We'll be talking about security for nuclear weapons, security for families, and it's the latter that gets short shrift. But I want to focus in on this question of, it's not brought up explicitly, but it's in there, and that is the question of the disposability of human beings and how much terror and horror you could wreak. And the assumption that goes with nuclear war is that hundreds of thousands to millions of casualties are acceptable, that that's just part of the terrain that you're talking about, that there's an inherent willingness to sacrifice cities, to have tremendous collateral damage. And if you look in detail at nuclear targeting plans and the role of nuclear weapons as they are seen by some of the advocates for some of the specific weapons that are part of the modernization plan, you realize that, well, why can't we take out, people ask me, why can't you take out such and such a target with a conventional weapon? Because now we have very precise conventional weapons. So it's just a matter of creating a certain pressure over the target, and it's crushed. So if it's a bunker or something like that. Well, the answer is that nuclear weapons have collateral damage. They create a terror factor that conventional weapons don't. And that terror that's part of deterrence is part of the justification for nuclear weapons at a fundamental level. So the willingness to create vast human casualties is one of the reasons why we have so many nuclear weapons of so many kinds. And that kind of political assumption infects our political system. And here in New Mexico, it infects our society as a whole.
I want to talk a little bit more about the attitude towards nuclear weapons. As someone who lives in New Mexico, I have heard rumors about the attitudes that occur up at Los Alamos National Laboratory or down at Kirtland Air Force Base. And the attitude I've heard from Los Alamos is a little bit sickening to me, frankly. This scientific aloofness paired with a calculated destructiveness of just exactly what would happen if we took out Kabul tomorrow, or if we dropped a bomb on Baghdad. This is horrific to me as a citizen. And, you know, one thing I learned by doing a little bit of due diligence and homework on nuclear weapons and really researching the stories of the Hibakusha, the survivors of nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, is that I think that many Americans, particularly those who grew up after the Cold War, as I did, we have an image of a mushroom cloud when we think nuclear weapon, this actually rather stately and strangely beautiful shape of a plume of smoke rising above the landscape. But the reality of nuclear weapons is things like people's eyeballs popping out from the force of the blow, people evaporated instantly because of the strength of the detonation of the bombs, people's bodies on fire running by millions for the only available source of water, people dying by the hundreds of thousands in the weeks that follow a nuclear bombing because of radiation sickness. So I'm wondering if you could speak more about the attitude that persists and exists around nuclear weapons today, maybe here in New Mexico, maybe on DC, you've mentioned a little bit of their attitude. I think it would be very informative for us to line up the attitudes of the people who are handling the policies and the practices of nuclear weapons with what I've just mentioned about the realities of nuclear weapons?
Yes, well, I think that's very important, the things that you touched upon there. And there is this, I think cavalier is a good word. You know, the movie Dr. Strangelove, for those who haven't seen it, remains extremely accurate in a lot of ways. The attitudes which are there, they persist in the heart of the nuclear weapons establishment. There's a kind of underground club, as it were. Sometimes it's literally underground, as in the case of Kirtland Air Force Base, where it's underground because of secrecy and because a lot of it is just because of the horror. You mentioned Kirtland Air Force Base. It is probably, almost certainly, the largest single repository of nuclear weapons in the world. The motto of the Kirtland Underground Munitions Maintenance and Storage Facility is a death from below. And if you go online, you'll find quite a few military patches of the people whose job it is to turn the key. And, you know, death wears bunny slippers, or an image of a figure of death carrying a scythe, riding a reentry vehicle, coming into the target and saying, on time, on target. Or just a simpler one that says, I nuke. There's a lot of this out there as people try to make sense psychologically of their role. At the labs, this has always been an extreme, it's a morally extreme environment. There were plans for some very large weapons, 100 megatons on up, you know, that would punch a hole in the atmosphere and, you know, burn down an entire state at a time. The weapons that we tested had mushroom clouds 100 miles across. I think that the Hiroshima and Nagasaki experience, while it's important to absorb it, it's also very small compared to the thermonuclear warheads that are in the stockpiles today. So one nuclear explosion would burn down basically all of Albuquerque if it were detonated over the Big Eye, let's say. The mass fires that would be started, basically these weapons create a sun that would be, say, 3,000 or 4,000 feet above the ground over, let's say, a city. Maybe it's at its height, it might be 1,000 times brighter than the desert sun at noon. Everything that is optically connected to that fireball will burst into flame, and all those fires coalesce and create vast hurricanes of fire all at once. Not like any kind of fire that you see, not like a forest fire or anything, but all at once. That smoke then rises into the stratosphere, where it does not settle or rain out, but rather the sun shining on the particles of soot from everything in a city or in a forest would keep those particles aloft and darken the earth beneath for a very long time. So, yes, sure, Atlantel, you know, after joking how many bombs would it take to create a tsunami in the Red Sea that would flood Iraq, let's say. After 9/11, there was a notice that went up on the bulletin board in the weapons program. It was a weather forecast for Kabul, Afghanistan. It said, tomorrow, sunny and 10,000 degrees. So, yes, it's very cavalier, and it's psychologically very damaging for people to work in that environment.
So let's talk a little bit about deterrence, because one of the interesting things about deterrence is that it's a theory that has been around since the beginning, basically. But coming straight out of LANL, Los Alamos National Laboratory, there was a scientist, James Doyle, who actually debunked the theory of deterrence and faced quite a bit of persecution from the lab because of that. Can you explain to the listeners just the very basic theory of deterrence, which I think people know, but it's good to rearticulate? And then what are the holes in that? Is it as valid as people think? Do we really need all these weapons to deter other people's weapons? Let's explore that a little bit.
Sure. We should say that there have been quite a few people undermining this theory and refining it. And what James Doyle did was bring some of those arguments together, and his, quote, thought crime was to be working at Los Alamos Lab while he did that. But quietly, there have been quite a few academics and military people that have begun to connect the dots in different ways. But because of political factors, that doesn't seem to affect policy too much yet. And prestige. And it comes back, practically everything comes back to the need to maintain dominance and perceived dominance in the world. And power vis-a-vis, especially power vis-a-vis Russia and China. So deterrence was former STRATCOM commander Lee Butler. He was the STRATCOM commander under the elder Bush, and he was responsible for the largest decrease in nuclear weapons that we've had so far, he and others around him in the first Bush administration. Lee Butler said, deterrence is just a word to stop thought, to keep people from thinking rationally about this problem. Of course, we're all familiar with the idea that sort of fundamental deterrence idea that if someone thinks you're going to do something back to them, they will not do something, they will not hurt you. Now, how that translates into the nuclear field is complicated and has become the vehicle for the grotesque world-ending arsenal. So as it currently stands, although, as we said, this is not really believed by the Nuclear Weapons Council, if we have mutual assured destruction, so if Russia launches an attack on the continental United States, then we would retaliate, and it would bring the world to an end. It would certainly be the end of Russia, the end of the United States, so we're threatening the annihilation of the other country if the other country attacks us, and so it is considered that this is stable. But the immediate question is, well, how many weapons does it require to achieve this stability? And the answer seems to be, it could be quite small if you believe in the idea to begin with. It doesn't take beyond a junior high school level thought about political science to suggest to you that if the nuclear weapons establishment and all the contractors were just one-tenth the size that they are today, the politics of this issue would be quite different, and we'd be able to think about it in a much different way. So Herbert York, who was head of Livermore Lab, used to say that I don't know how many nuclear weapons it takes to deter. It's somewhere between 1 and 100, closer to 1 than 200. And in practice, we practically pretty much see that almost now with respect to North Korea, that is getting to the point where people fear North Korea, and they don't really even have any actual weapons that could fly on missiles, as far as we know. But they might soon, and they have their boats. So suddenly North Korea is a country that you don't want to mess with. So, you know, how many do we need to have our present, what is it, about 7,000 nuclear weapons? About 2,000 deployed, all told, or depending on how you count them. I don't really think that we have a clear idea of how many weapons are, how close to deployment that is classified. So we have an official figure, and then we have thousands of weapons in reserve. And exactly how many hours or days those are away from deployment is not clear to the public. So deterrence, yes, it's a very flexible concept that can accommodate a $1 trillion modernization plan, or it could start sliding down without risk to the United States, without risk to strategic stability, and with an invitation to other countries to join us in this gradual disarmament process. And that's really, it's separate from the ban process, but it's something we could do tomorrow. Obama could write this on a napkin at lunch tomorrow, but he doesn't.
You know, it's such an interesting discussion, because what really keeps us safe, what really keeps us secure, these are fundamental questions that people are constantly asking each other, particularly since 9/11. The question of security has become quite well populated for a variety of both noble and nefarious reasons. But those of us who have followed peace studies and issues on the other end of the spectrum really understand that weapons and domination are really not keeping us all that secure compared to what could be done with right relations, respect, dignity, active peacemaking, active peace building, finding ways of creating economic justice worldwide, demilitarization. It's a whole other paradigm that's out there for people to understand and to really think about what makes us safe. So I think it's important to mention that paradigm when talking about nuclear weapons, which are certainly some of the extreme of the other end of the domination, if not the extreme of the other end of the domination game.
Can I quickly add something to that, which should be said on this show?
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. And for those who care deeply about the climate and the environment, we will not get there without disarmament. So that's why it's all one issue. That's why we don't have the money and we don't have the political attention. I didn't make it very clear before, but that's the nut of the problem here. You have these two paradigms, which you've mentioned, and it's not something that we don't have the luxury of some gradual shift in our thinking anymore. Sure, there's between 1,000 and zero, there's smaller numbers. Sure, it's just a logical truth. However, you've got to be clear about the political goals, and you have to consider how much time we have before positive feedbacks in the climate take shape and before people truly die from the injustices that you're talking about. I mean, they're dying now. We're destroying one country after another out of this dominance paradigm, and we believe that people need to get into the streets to mobilize first and then understand. So don't try to understand everything first. Reach out to your friends and to your colleagues and take action and learn while you're doing it.
At the very least, demand that $1 trillion be allocated to our social programs that it's coming from right now. Greg, this has been a really amazing conversation, and I just want to let the listeners know that Greg is the co-founder of the Los Alamos Study Group. It's been around since 1989. As you've heard on this show, they're doing well-researched and articulate work on providing leadership for nuclear disarmament. They do have a great website. And Greg, as you offer some closing remarks to our listeners today, maybe you can make sure they know where to find out more about what you're doing.
Sure. If you're in central New Mexico, we're going to have a talk on November 11th at the center stage on Camino de los Marques. It's across from Trader Joe's, central Santa Fe, November 11th, 6:30 p.m. So we're going to talk about new directions in nuclear disarmament that are opening up, and the relation of this issue to others, and have a public discussion about it, because it is breaking open now. So that's one thing. And I guess I would just like to emphasize that we need to get active. We're in a brand new political paradigm now, whether we understand it completely, and none of us can, or not. But there are new opportunities and new dangers, and history is happening very fast, and we can be part of that. And it's very positive as well as very scary.
Well, thank you, Greg, for making sure that people do understand how important action is, and for consistently providing the education and the understanding at the same time. It's been a pleasure having you on today's show.
Thank you so much, Rivera, and keep up with your good work there, too.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to our guest Greg Mello. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by her and Spirit Radio. You can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org. We are a weekly radio program, and with any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on my website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Stitcher, iTunes, and Podomatic. Now, listeners, we've covered many aspects of the nuclear weapons issue on today's show with Greg Mello. And as he mentioned, there's a historic treaty to ban nukes in front of the UN as we're going to air. So perhaps, with a little bit of luck and a little bit of wisdom, we'll all be one step closer to a nuke-free world by the time we talk to you next week. What if you knew?